Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Northfield Insurance versus City of Waukegan. Ms. Petry?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Paulette Petretti on behalf of the City of Waukegan and the named police officers. The issue on appeal is whether St. Paul Fire and Marine and Northfield Insurance Company's law enforcement liability policies are triggered by a civil rights complaint filed by Benny Starks. The district court determined that there would be no coverage. The city insureds disagree. And today I'd like to focus on three points which we maintain should serve as grounds for reversal. First, the district court abused its discretion when it denied the city insured's motion to stay the declaratory judgment action. The request to stay was related to Benny Stark's civil rights case, which has been stayed pending the outcome of Stark's criminal proceedings. We maintain the declaratory judgment should have been similarly stayed. Second, St. Paul's policy, which was in effect from November 2006 to November 2007, was triggered by Stark's claim of malicious prosecution because Stark's civil rights complaint expressly alleged a favorable outcome occurred on January 20th, 2007, a date that occurred within St. Paul's policy period. And third, we maintain that Stark's complaint alleges discrete civil rights violations other than false arrest and malicious prosecution, which present potential claims occurring during both carriers' policies. So first, why was Judge Kaur's denial of a stay erroneous? Judge Kaur's ruling was a rush to judgment before the issues were ripe in this case. Because Judge Kaur went forward with a declaratory judgment suit, the city insureds are now foreclosed from any coverage under appellee's policies, regardless of what happens with Stark's civil rights case. The city insureds believe that this was a premature decision. And in his opinion, Judge Kaur admitted that it was quite unclear whether Stark's has been exonerated for purposes of triggering coverage related to his Section 1983 claims. Judge Kaur recognized that he was entering uncharted waters when he commented that the Seventh Circuit had not previously, quote, faced the kind of murky situation that makes this case unusual. In the face of this uncertainty, it's puzzling why Judge Kaur would proceed with such drastic consequences.
Ms. Petretti, in your brief, you call that a biased ruling.
Judge Kaur's ruling was biased.
That's what you said.
Yes.
What's the basis for that accusation?
That it was rendered with just one side, basically, that he took into consideration.
Did you not have an opportunity to be heard?
We had an opportunity to be heard, but he had...
Is this anything more than just a disagreement?
No, Your Honor, we...
Then why do you call it biased?
We call it biased because we think it was not ripe at the time. We believe that all the facts were not known, and we base that on...
Let me be specific. Calling a judge's decision biased has a lot more freight behind it than saying it was wrong or that it was premature. And I don't hear any foundation for that accusation.
And perhaps, if I could explain, one of our arguments was that before we knew what the underlying case, which was this Benny Wright civil rights case, how the outcome of his criminal proceedings would turn out, Judge Kaur cut the city off and foreclosed them from any potential coverage. Judge Kaur's determination was based on his speculation, and I maybe that would have been a better way to put it, that he speculated that there was only one way the criminal trial could end up, which would be that either Benny Starks would be retried and he would be either guilty or acquitted. And our argument, which Judge Kaur really did not take into account was that there was another option, that he may not be retried, that the case would be nolle prosequi, and the date that was alleged in the complaint, the January 20th, 2007 date, would be the operative date for the malicious prosecution.
Is it fair to say you're withdrawing then the accusation of bias?
Your Honor, I will withdraw that accusation. And if I could just, as I say, recharacterize it as being speculative. And therefore, his speculation was in looking at one viewpoint rather than both viewpoints.
I don't know. Maybe you could tell me why the nolle pros in 2012 reverts the triggering date back to 2007.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't get that one at all.
The under Swick versus Littoud, which is an Illinois Supreme Court
case.
And
I don't understand why this late development in the case should affect our decision anyway.
Well, Your Honor, the case has been based on the speculation of what would happen in the criminal case. And as far as the development, this is the development that we've been waiting for. The Judge Kaur speculated.
Well, this is long after the policy expired, so what difference does it make?
Because, Your Honor, malicious prosecution under McFatridge, National Casualty Insurance versus McFatridge, and American Safety versus the City of Waukegan set forth the rule of law that when there is a claim for malicious prosecution, the insurance policy that was in effect at the time that the plaintiff was exonerated is the date that triggers insurance coverage. And therefore, that has been the germane issue in this case, this declaratory.
Yeah, but the policy isn't in effect in 2012, so what difference does it make what happened in 2012?
Your Honor, that's exactly what we're saying. The nolle pros in 2012 puts this case back to...
Why?
Because under the law, if a nolle pros is entered, and if the order itself does not explain why the case has been nolle prosed, then the underlying circumstances are reviewed, and it essentially puts the case back to where it was at the beginning of the prosecution. And our argument
which would be 1986.
Well, but, Your Honor, there is murkiness in this case. In 1986, there were many different allegations, and Benny Stark was charged not only with criminal sexual assault, but also aggravated battery.
Look, Swick Swick requires, and the other Illinois cases, Cult Awareness Network and so on, require favorable termination.
Correct.
We don't have favorable termination until this month, and there's still some room to argue about whether this nolle pros is inconsistent with innocence or consistent with innocence. Somebody's going to have to worry about that at some point. But I have this basically the same question. I don't see how you take a 2012 nolle pros and say this restores us to 2007.
Well, Your Honor, the nolle pros does put an end to the litigation of the criminal sexual assault and the sexual assault charges. He's not going to be retried on those. And then the analysis begins. You look at the nolle pros and to determine whether it's a favorable outcome. The case law says if there is nothing in the face of the order which indicates why they're nolle prosing the case, then you look at the underlying circumstances. And it puts the case back to where it was prosecuted. Now,
let me see. I think I see where you're going. But if you think it has a retroactive effect like that for 5 years for purposes of insurance coverage, do you think it has the same effect for the statute of limitations?
I think it may. Yes, I think it may. Because
are you kidding? So that Sparks is So the statute has now run because it took 5 years to get from the appellate reversal to the nolle pros?
And, Your Honor, the
Is the city going to take that position?
Well, Your Honor, if I just may say, I don't know. But all I can say is in the complaint, which rules, I think, the coverage issue, the Stark's attorney has indicated that he filed when he did because of the statute of limitations.
Sure. He's got to be careful and cautious about that, and he's protected his but under your theory, if he had not done that, then the 2012 nolle pros would mean that the statute of limitations had run before the cause of action had accrued, right?
Well, if the cause of action accrued in 2007 when...
That's your theory.
If you use that theory, the statute would have run.
That seems troubling.
Your Honor, I think it's arguable. I think that in terms of the favorable outcome, and I say that only because the case law talks about looking at the underlying circumstances, and that if that is the event for purposes of these sexual assault charges, that was the favorable outcome when they were reversed. Now, the thing that makes this case murky is that he still has an aggravated battery charge that he is convicted of, and which was never overturned. So there are also arguments, I'm sure, that he still has not been exonerated because he is still a convicted felon. But for purposes
well,
of
that doesn't help your case very much, does it?
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that's an argument. But for coverage, I go back to the complaint. With regard to coverage, it is important and it is driven by the complaint itself. And the reason why the January 20th, 2007 date is important is because it is alleged in the complaint that he was exonerated on January 20th, 2007. And under cult awareness, which is a Supreme Court case, the complaint is the driving factor for coverage purposes. And that's why we have always alleged, and now we brought the nolle pros to the court's attention because it happened, and if we hadn't, we think it would have been, you know, deceptive. The court needs to know that it happened. But even before the nolle pros, we had been arguing that the January 20th, 2007 date was the operative date for exoneration for the malicious prosecution claim.
Maybe this question was answered in your briefs, but is there other insurance coverage for the incidents in question here?
Well, Your Honor, this when we got the complaint, this covers a 20-year period. And so the city notified all the carriers during that 20-year period just to put them on notice. So it's going to come down to what the courts determined to be the operative date for malicious prosecution.
It looks like there are three separate cases involving the different insurance carriers for this incident. Is that right?
Right now, there are.
Why on earth are there three separate cases?
Your Honor, the insurers raised...
You're presumably in a good position to let the other judges know what's going on and to suggest that maybe it would make sense to sort all these things out in a consistent way in front of one judge, right?
We did, Your Honor, but actually we raised that in front of Judge Corr, who had the first declaratory judgment action, and he rejected it. He would not allow any other carriers to intervene. So that was rejected. But with the other, Judge Gettleman and Judge Kokoris also have declaratory judgment actions. They have both stayed them pending the outcome of the criminal proceeding. So we maintain that, you know, in those situations, there's been no harm to anybody, and we're waiting the resolution. With regard to the remainder of the complaint, the other argument that we have is that the complaint also alleges discrete constitutional violations that are separate and apart from false arrest or malicious prosecution. He has claimed conspiracy.
Let me back up and let me ask you, if you're successful in this litigation, what happens to the other coverage?
The other coverage, there may be that more than one carrier is going to be triggered. Under McFatridge and under American Safety, clearly there are at least two carriers that are going to be triggered, one at the time of the arrest and one at the time of the malicious prosecution. So we're definitely going to have two carriers in. With regard to my other arguments, in that interim period, we maintain that there are other discrete constitutional violations that have been raised.
What are those?
He has alleged conspiracy, which is a Section 1983 conspiracy, and under Brooks versus Ross, that would have a separate triggering point when the overt acts occur. He has also alleged First and Eighth Amendment claims, although they are not fleshed out. And we maintain, though, it's still too early to know, because he may possibly have some claims, as prisoners are wont to do, claiming religious persecution.
Against the Waukegan police?
Your Honor, even if right now the Waukegan police and the city of Waukegan are the only municipalities that are named, if he raises those claims, and like some of the claims that have been raised, we believe there are defenses against them, as you're suggesting. But nonetheless, whatever carrier is on the trigger for that should help the city with the defense of those claims. I mean, it may be that they'd get dismissed out, but as far as coverage goes, it still triggers coverage. Your Honors, I am now going into my rebuttal period, and I would like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Halpern.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Jeff Halpern. I'm here on behalf of the Appalese Northfield Insurance Company and St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company. If you apply McFatridge and American Safety and those and the trigger decisions that this court came down with in those cases, our summary judgment should be affirmed. Now, the interesting part of my argument is going to be what we suggested in our briefs, which is that this panel should reconsider those trigger rulings, because there's a distinction between when a tort accrues and when coverage is triggered under an insurance policy. You have to separate out the elements of the tort from the elements of the insurance contract. All right, but let me start at the beginning.
Wait, do you want to spend all your time trying to convince us to overrule McFatridge and American Safety on this point?
Not all my time, but obviously I'll spend my time any way you see fit, Your Honor.
Well, it may be more fruitful to try other directions.
Fair enough. Let me start.
Let's start with this. Sparks's complaint, right or wrong, alleges favorable termination in 2007, right?
Correct.
During St. Paul's coverage period. That may be wrong as a matter of law on the claims, but I thought the general idea in liability insurance coverage is that no matter how frivolous or baseless or even fraudulent the underlying claim might be, there's still a duty to defend and indemnify, even if all you would need to do is file a three-page summary judgment motion that says the appellate reversal is not exoneration.
Well, I think, and in response to your question, Your Honor, I think you have to take a step back and take a look at what exactly happened on that January 20th, 2007 date. The only thing that happened on January 20th, 2007, which was within our policy period, that's the only thing that happened within any of our policy periods, was the issuance of the mandate from the appellate court sending the case back down after its 2006 decision, mm-hmm. which preceded our policy, and the 2006 decision reversed and remanded.
Okay. No, my point is, isn't that a debate you should have with Sparks rather than with your insured?
And I would argue that, no, you have to go to what the law provides with respect to what is the triggering event.
How about the complaint, though? That's what Judge Hamilton was asking about. Coverage is basically a matter of the complaint in these cases.
Well, even if you look at, first off, there's not been, I understand that, that point. If you look at the contract itself, the contract itself requires that there be a wrongful act or an occurrence that happens within the policy period.
So what is alleged? right?
No, you have to compare the allegations of the complaint with the contract itself. Where the contract itself lays out that there must be a wrongful act by the insured or an occurrence by the insured that occurred during the policy period, you have to see, okay, what happened? What was the wrongful act? What was the event that the insured did during the policy period? Nothing happened on January 20th, 2007. There was no wrongful act.
The plaintiff, Sparks, is alleging that that was the final triggering event for his malicious prosecution claim. Now, that may be wrong, but that's the allegation. So why don't you take up the dispute with Sparks in his civil rights suit in defending your insured to make that point?
Because when you're making a coverage decision, you have to compare the allegations of the complaint to the policy. And the policy itself, which is the contract of insurance between you and, in this case, the city of Waukegan, there's no coverage there under the contract the way the contract reads.
Why not?
Because there's no occurrence, there's no wrongful act.
The plaintiff alleges
the mandate.
The plaintiff alleges the occurrence. Look, if suppose we're talking about an automobile accident that never actually happened. It's a fraudulent claim. You can't reject coverage by saying there was no occurrence, can you?
I would think that's accurate.
You've got to defend your insured, and then you go in and say there was no occurrence, there was no accident. We win, right? So why doesn't that work here?
If I could have the opportunity to review the Starks complaint quickly, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, I think perhaps counsel is exaggerating what exactly the underlying complaint says with respect to the accrual. The underlying complaint lays out both the March 23, 2006 date as being the date the Illinois Appellate Court reversed the denial of plaintiff's post-conviction petition and vacated his conviction. Subsequently, it lays out that the mandate of the appellate court reversing plaintiff's conviction was issued on January 20th, 2007. I don't think it goes into what the triggering event might be. That wasn't the underlying plaintiff's concern. All he was doing was laying out dates in his underlying complaint. So I think then you have to take a look at what's alleged in the complaint and compare that with the policy, as well as the case law that's out there that interprets insurance law, and determine, okay, what triggers coverage here? Is the issuance of a mandate a mandate? All a mandate is a administrative, ministerial task that's accomplished by the clerk of the court, not even the judge. I mean,
it doesn't happen without the judge's approval.
Well, that's true, but what would happen if the clerk acts upon the reversal and remand that was issued by the appellate court in this instance? There's case law we said in our brief that says because there was the remand involved, it's not a triggering event. The appellate court decision itself is not a triggering event. So what would make then the subsequent mandate back to the trial court a triggering event? It doesn't make any sense.
This is an allegation of law rather than fact in the complaint?
Correct. And I don't even think the allegation of law is made in the complaint. All the complaint does is spell out the dates.
Inferred allegation of law. Is that?
I would agree with that. Inferred allegation of law. If you look at McFatridge and American Safety, the two triggering dates that are laid out in those opinions, false arrest is the date of the arrest. Here that's 1986. That precedes all these policies. Date of exoneration is the second date with respect to the malicious prosecution allegations and related claims. And we can have an argument as to what exactly the exoneration is here, but I think clearly that nothing happened within our policy periods that constitutes an exoneration. The only thing that happened in our policy periods was the issuance of that mandate. I mean, if the clerk sat on that mandate for 6 months, forgot about it, and, you know, was gently reminded by someone, whether it be the court or a party, a litigant, saying, hey, you forgot to issue the mandate. Oh, sorry about that. Mandate then issues. All that does is just revest the matter, revest jurisdiction back down to the trial court for further criminal proceedings. It seems it doesn't make any sense that that act alone would constitute the triggering act for either under the policy or for a wrongful termination, a malicious prosecution claim. That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, there's nothing the trial court could do with regard to the other charge, the one that they reversed.
Well, and that's what, and I think when we heard the term murky, I think what Judge Kaur was referring to was the fact that in this case, you had the battery convictions, they're still there. The what was vacated.
Well, exoneration is pretty murky to start with, isn't it?
That's a very true point, which is.
Maybe that's why the case should have been stayed. I don't know.
Well, with respect to the motion to stay, first off, it's discretionary with the trial court judge as to whether to grant it or not. I don't think we've seen an abuse of discretion that's been demonstrated. Second off, all the material genuine issues of fact here with respect to the trigger issue, there were none. There were no genuine material issues. They were all very clear. And so in light of the fact that he could make this trigger ruling with respect to our policies, given where they sit in the time frame of this case, I don't think that denying the motion to stay was an abuse of discretion by any stretch. With respect to the appellant's argument about the continuous trigger theory, that's not been applied by any court that's been looking at these types of cases, malicious prosecution, false arrest, wrongful detention, anything like that. Nobody's ever applied the continuous trigger to these types of cases, and appellants don't cite a case to Your Honors that does.
I mean, a case comes to mind. I don't know that insurance coverage was disputed, but many years ago, there was a police officer in Milwaukee shot and killed a suspect, planted a drop knife on the body, there was a 20-year conspiracy of silence. The case is called Bell against City of Milwaukee, decided by this court back in 1984. But the police officers in the case maintained a 20-year conspiracy of silence that was finally broken when one fella came forward. Now, in that case, it didn't involve conviction, but arguably, because the man had been shot and killed, but what if there's a 20-year conspiracy of silence among police officers to conceal exculpatory evidence, for example, that ultimately breaks down and you have exoneration? Why shouldn't we treat that 20-year period as a continuing wrong?
Well, initially, there are no such allegations in our case, so I want to make that clear. But secondly, if this court in the McFatris decision adopted the Wallace v. Cato approach that says with these types of allegations, there are really two separate areas of tort. One, there's the wrongful arrest portion of it, and the second is the malicious prosecution portion of it. Everything else falls in either one of those two camps. There's no continuing tort in the middle. You know, we've heard a lot about mental anguish in the briefs and mental harm. All that falls in the beginning.
That does, sure. But what about the conspiracy of silence?
Well, I think in the cases that we've cited, and there's 20 or 30 of them, I can't think of one off the top of my head, I think there were allegations in those cases relating to conspiracies. And in those cases, none of those courts applied the continuous trigger either. I mean, the continuous trigger and the case cited by the appellants for the continuous trigger was a situation involving continued sexual abuse of a minor over a period of years and involved a negligent supervision claim. But with a negligent supervision claim, you know, when you're supervising on a day-to-day basis, that might change. So I could see how the underlying act might change. But here, the damage and the injury is manifested as soon as that person is locked up improperly.
Well, there's obviously a difference between serving 1 year in prison unjustly and serving 25 years unjustly, right?
24 years.
Yeah.
I think that would go towards damages, but yes.
But wouldn't there be wrongful conduct by the police officers during those intervening 20 years?
I think if you look at when the injury and damage first is realized by the person who is incarcerated, that's realized when they are first locked up. Realized when they are first locked up improperly, I should say. So I would say that even under those circumstances, it would relate back to the date of the arrest and the date of the
claim isn't even ripe under McFatridge and American Safety.
Well, and that's why I would disagree. And I know you gave me a strong warning at the beginning of this argument, but that's why I think there should be a change from focusing in on when the cause of action accrues and when it accrues under, you know, when insurance coverage is triggered. I think you have to look at the terms of the policy, and when the policy requires a wrongful act, you know, an act of exoneration, however you define what that exoneration might be, an exoneration, that's not a wrongful act, that's a rightful act. I mean, that's the antithesis of a wrongful act. So I don't see, if you compare it to the terms of the policy, I don't think that this, I think that it's appropriate to analyze these two situations separately. When the tort accrues, when insurance coverage is triggered.
Well, as the nature of the language and contracts changed since these decisions?
I'm sorry.
Has the nature of the language in the contract changed since the decisions of this court?
Not as far as I know, Your Honor.
You don't want to change, but you want us to change.
Well, I guess the short answer to that would be yes. You know, this is not with the whole continuous trigger argument. This is not an instance where we're having a latent defect. Like you would also see, it's also been applied in, say, asbestos cases. I think it's also been applied in environmental cases where there's latent defects. We don't have latent defects or latent injuries here. You know, the injuries manifested themselves when this individual was held wrongfully, when he was wrongfully convicted, and he's held in jail. He knows right away that he's been damaged. That injury is very apparent right then. So I think that distinguishes all these continuous trigger cases
if that's right,
from this case.
If that's right, then I mean the reasoning of our court, in addition to just trying to do our best to predict Illinois law, is that you could have 20 and 30 year tails of coverage. Is that what the industry wants?
Well, you know, I don't know what the industry wants. All I know is what my insurance company wants.
Okay.
My insurance companies want this contract of insurance with these insureds to be enforced. And, I mean, I think the premise of your question is, you know, why do you issue occurrence policies then? That's, I mean, occurrence policies exist. This is not a claims-made policy. This is an occurrence policy.
Given this mess, shouldn't cities try to buy claims-made policies? Because, I mean, if we agree with you, then there shouldn't be any coverage. Then the relevant coverage would be possibly what's in effect this month, right, when the Nellie Pross was issued, if that's later determined to be consistent with innocence. And I assume that in April 2012 it would have been impossible for the city of Waukegan to buy insurance that would cover Mr. Sparks, right?
Well, may I respond to that?
A known loss.
I don't know if it is under your McFatridge and American Safety decisions, and that's why I think you should change them. I think it's the trigger date under those two decisions is subject to manipulation by the municipality, and that's a clear indication that perhaps you should revisit that issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, they could have gone out last month and got an extra $15 million worth of excess coverage. Now, whether they would have needed to disclose that or not would be an arguable issue. Two decisions, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you're subjecting the trigger date of an insurance policy to manipulation, you're leading to all sorts of big issues. Good insurance coverage work for attorneys, but I'm not sure if that's
the phrase moral hazard does come to mind and known losses. So.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was my question earlier about other coverage for this incident.
Well, and Judge, it's my understanding that they are currently being defended. Now, there was a motion to consolidate our case with some of those other coverage cases, and that motion was denied. So, you know, I wanted to point out something, and that is, and I heard this during counsel's argument, and you can go back and check the record. When you were talking about the Noli Pros and its effect, I think she mentioned that the Noli Pros, the cause of action accrues when they, the convictions, were reversed. Well, that statement acknowledges that they were reversed on the March 26, 2006 opinion that was issued by the appellate court. She's not saying they were reversed at the time of the mandate. She's saying they, when those convictions were reversed in March of 2006.
That's not going to hunt. Until the mandate issues, the court's decision is subject to revision.
I'm sorry?
Until the mandate issues, the decision is subject to revision.
Well, that's true, but all the mandate does is send the I don't even know if that is true. I mean, I'm thinking back to my time.
Nobody has to follow our decisions until we issue a mandate.
Fair enough. But I'm not sure if the appellate court could take it on its own, the Illinois appellate court, with Justice, the esteemed Justice McLaren, I might add. I'm not sure if he could take it on his own to issue a new opinion without, on his own before, you know, after that March 26th
opinion. Well, you usually need another vote.
Fair enough.
But one's enough.
Fair enough. I see my red light is on. Your Honors, I would urge you to, if apply the facts of or the decisions of American Safety and McFatridge to our case and determine that there's no coverage. I would also urge you to revisit those issues entirely and determine a different track to follow the majority position with respect to triggering these types of cases.
Thank you, counsel. Much time? 2.5 minutes.
Your Honors, I would like to just address the argument about the continuous trigger. I think that counsel has misinterpreted that. We acknowledge that any conduct that is related to the invalidation of the conviction is subsumed in the malicious prosecution claim. Our argument is that the complaint alleges discrete torts, such as the conspiracy, which is a discrete tort and would have a different triggering point. And also, he does allege, although not with specificity, First and Eighth Amendment claims, constitutional violations. Now, if this gets fleshed out and he makes a claim that he was religiously persecuted under the First Amendment, that claim has nothing to do with the invalidation of his conviction. That would be a separate, discrete tort, and whenever that happened, that would trigger the policy that was in effect at the time. Now, there may be defenses against it. The statute of limitations might apply, but that doesn't make any difference because under the complaint, if he's alleging that, the carrier still needs to come in and provide a defense. And the same thing would be true under the Eighth Amendment. We have lots of cases out there where prisoners are claiming that they've been cruelly and unjustly treated. We cited to one, Heard versus Sheehan, where the prisoner had a bulging hernia, and he complained over the years, and this court found that that was a continuing violation. It had nothing to do with his malicious prosecution, had nothing to do with the invalidation of his complaint, but it was a discrete tort. And I think the reason this is so important, Benny Starks was in prison for 20 years. We don't know what he's going to say happened while he was in there. And he has already alerted the court and alerted, you know, the parties that he suffered. And he suffered injuries. And those are going to come out with more specificity. Under federal pleading standards, he doesn't have to put every detail in his complaint. So our position is, if there is any doubt whatsoever, the city should not have been foreclosed before all the facts are fleshed out from coverage, particularly since right in the complaint, Starks alleged that he was exonerated on January 20th, 2007.
Where do we see that?
That, Your Honor, is in paragraph 35 of the complaint when he says the mandate of the appellate court reversing plaintiff's conviction was issued on January 20th, 2007. So he alleges that, and that's it.
Well, that's what's that an allegation of? Of an act of a court?
Correct, Your Honor, but that's the only thing.
It has nothing to do with his lawsuit, does it?
But he's a plaintiff. He doesn't have to allege something that's going to trigger an insurance policy. I mean, that I think the law
is
clear.
Well, you're saying that's what he did, aren't you?
But you compare the policy terms with the allegations, and if there is anything in
the... Yeah, I understand. The allegation is a fact that applies to, but I'm not sure what this is an allegation of.
That his convictions were overturned on that date. That's a favorable resolution of his convictions. And that is that's what triggers malicious prosecution.
Well, his allegation of what triggers anything, I don't think that's a part of the complaint for purposes of coverage.
But the coverage analysis has to compare to, and if the date is there, then even if it's a potential claim, the law says that the carrier must provide coverage if there is a duty to defend. And we have maintained that there are duty to defend in both of the policies. My time is up, Your Honor, and I want to thank you, and we urge reversal on this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.